This is Ron Stockton. I want to talk to you about a legal case that has really upset me. I learned about it from an article in The New Yorker by the amazing writer Rachel Aviv. It was about the noted author Alice Sebold. Many of you will know Sebold for her novel The Lovely Bones. It was a bestseller, 10 million copies, and was made into a movie. Jane read it in a book group, and we watched the film. It's about a 14-year-old girl who's raped and murdered. Her body was never found, so even her death cannot be confirmed. In heaven, she is allowed to look down on the lives of those people who were her friends and family and see how they react to her disappearance. She is present at family dinners, but no one knows she's there. In a sense, she is in a dissociative state. She is there, but not there. Life moves on, as it always did, but she is disconnected from what is happening. In retrospect, it is obvious that the novel was written by someone who had been raped. Sebold had written an earlier book, a memoir. It was called Lucky. It reported how, as an 18-year-old freshman at Syracuse University, she was grabbed one night, the very last night of her freshman year, dragged into the bushes, and raped. The rape was violent, both physically and sexually. For example, she was beaten with a brick to make her submit. The ground was covered with broken glass, which slashed her back during the assault. I'm going to leave out the other details. Her rapist was a black man. During the assault, she had the presence of mind to decide two things. First, she decided that she would remember every possible detail about the event and about her assailant. The second decision was that she would survive. She would not resist. She would even help her rapist undress her. As he demanded various things of her, she kept saying, "I'm a virgin. I don't know how to do that." But she did what she was told. When the assault ended, he asked if he could hug her. He told her that she was a good girl. Then he said to her, "I'll see you again." What was that? Was it a threat? She certainly saw it that way. Alice also knew, even during the event, that she would write about what happened. Lucky sold over 1 million copies. When Alice reported the event to the police, the officer was proper but wrote in his notes that he was skeptical about the details. He recommended that this be sent to the inactive file. When she discussed it with her parents, her father, a professor of classical literature, seemed to blame her. "She should not have been out after dark without an escort," he said. "And how could she have been raped if she did not want to be?" Her mother seemed almost indifferent. But 5 months later, when the new school year started, she was back at Syracuse. Some of her friends were surprised that she had returned to the place where the most traumatic event in her life had occurred. But there were two professors she wanted to study with. One was Tess Gallagher, a poet. For her class, Alice wrote a long, rambling poem about her rape that few students even understood. Gallagher told her she should write poems that matter. She told her to write a new poem that began with the line, "If they caught you." Alice did. This time it was direct. It had the redemptive power of revenge as its theme. Let me read it to you. "If they caught you long enough for me to see that face again, maybe I would know your name. I could stop calling you the rapist and start calling you John or Luke or Paul. I want to make my hatred large and whole. If they found you, I could take those solid red balls and slice them separately off as everyone watched. I've already planned what I would do for a pleasurable kill, a slow, soft ending. First, I would kick you hard and straight with a boot into you. Stare while you shot quick and loose, contents a bloody pink hue. Next, I would slice out your tongue. You couldn't curse or scream. Only a face of pain would speak. For you, your thick ignorance through. Thirdly, I would hack away those sweet cow eyes with the glass blades you made me lie down on. Or should I shoot you with a gun, close in the knee, where they say the cap shatters immediately? I picture you now, your fingers rubbing sleep from those live, blind eyes, while I rise restlessly. I need the blood of your hide in my hands. I want to kill you with boots and guns and glass. I want to fuck you with knives. Come to me. Come to me. Come die and lie beside me. Alice felt liberated by that poem. Professor Gallagher loved it. She had Alice workshop the poem, i.e. ask the class to discuss and critique it. She said that every student had to respond. Several were angry that they had to comment. Most did not react with kindness. One refused to speak and walked out. One guy asked, "You don't really feel that way, do you? You don't want to shoot him in the knees and that other stuff with the knives? You can't feel that way." Alice was blunt. "Yes, I do. I hate him. I want to kill him." She had another class later that day, a class with a professor of fiction. Between classes, she walked over to a nearby snack shop to get a sandwich. Returning to class, she saw a police officer standing there, and then she saw her rapist. "Hey, don't I know you from somewhere?" he said. He was bold and confident. Walking in the midst of a student business enclave, knowing he had gotten away with it. She tensed up as he walked towards her. Then she realized he had been speaking to the policeman. Later he said, "That officer was a patrolman in my neighborhood. I spoke to him several times." But that was not how she saw it. When he left, she went over to the officer and said, "That man raped me." He was promptly arrested. His name was Anthony Broadwater. The trial was not a long one. The local prosecutor had lost 9 rape cases in a row and was determined that this one would not fail. Siebold had identified her assailant in a police lineup. She also pointed him out in court. His defense attorney asked her, "How many black people do you see in this courtroom?" Broadwater was the only one. But Siebold was a good witness. She was articulate and had command of the details of what happened. And she was unequivocal. That was the man who had raped her. And at least 3 times before the grand jury, the prosecution mentioned that she had been a virgin. The 2-day trial was a bench trial before a judge, without a jury. Alice was only there 1 day, the day she gave testimony. She was absent the day Broadwater testified. The judge spoke to Alice during a break. He had 4 daughters. He was very sympathetic to her. He found the defendant guilty and sentenced him to 28 years. The defendant had insisted to his attorney that he was innocent, that he would never have done such a thing. The defense attorney was stunned at the verdict. He had told Broadwater that this was a very weak case, and he would be exonerated. The appeal was denied. But there were some real concerns about the evidence. Broadwater had a noticeable scar on his face and a chipped tooth, facts never mentioned by Alice in spite of her remarkable command of the details of what happened. And she was absent at her sister's graduation the day he testified. Also, during the lineup, she had identified Person 5 as her rapist. In fact, Broadwater, the suspect, was Person 4. When the prosecutor pointed this out, she said, "I meant Person 4. The prosecutor told her that she had just been stressed and that misidentifications were common on the first try. She was also told that Person 5 was a dead ringer for Person 4. They were friends in the cell block, and Person 5 had been recruited by the assailant to confuse her. The false identification was explained away. Her identification was changed to Person 4. Let me pause for a minute and enter this narrative as myself. I had never read Siebold's famous novel or her memoir, But as soon as I read the article by Aviv, I rushed to the library and checked out the novel. I also found the memoir used on the internet. Certainly my thinking on these issues was affected by knowing what had happened, but still, I had a reaction, which I like to think I would have had in any case. I had been faculty ombudsman on my campus for 17 years and dealt with a lot of issues. My approach was always to focus upon due process and the credibility of the evidence. I was very cautious about reaching conclusions. I love the novel and I love that memoir. It captured the way a young woman reacted to that traumatic event. It was almost as if we readers could imagine the glass cutting into her back. That was an event that all young women fear. Most who experience it don't want to talk about it, but Siebel was bold and honest in telling her story. Bravo for her. But when we got to the grand jury and the trial, I began to feel uneasy. I would like to think that my reaction would have been the same, even if I had not read the article in the New Yorker. Explaining away the identification of Person 5 as the assailant and reassigning guilt to Person 4, that the prosecutor knew to be Broadwater, was a shock. And telling Siebold that the accused person had recruited a friend who looked like him, a dead ringer, she was told, was an absolute fabrication. Accused persons don't get to decide who's going to be in the lineup. Telling Siebel that was more than a mistake. It was manipulation of a witness. It was a lie. No wonder Broadwater's attorney told him, based on the evidence, that there was no chance of a conviction. What he did not know was that the evidence was being rigged. And then there was the issue of race. At least three times Siebel was described as a virgin. That was not relevant to the case. Under the law, a prostitute and a virgin are both protected from rape. Previous sexual history has nothing to do with it. I don't want to be inflammatory, but this seemed to me like an effort to conjure up historic memories. I began to think, this man is being lynched. A black man is accused of raping a virtuous white female, and they keep emphasizing how virtuous she was. Innocent, sweet, good family, well-educated, a virgin, a virgin, a virgin. We could almost see her perfect white skin. It sounded like something out of the 1930s in Mississippi. The outcome seemed inevitable. And does it really matter if the person doing the lynching was wearing a black robe or a white robe? In prison, Broadwater went before the parole board time after time. He had gone to a counseling program to help convicts come to grips with what they had done. This would count in his favor in any appeal, but in his case it did not. Why? Because he was insistent that he had not committed the rape. He tried many ways to equivocate in his answers, saying that he was ashamed of his past offenses without ever specifying what those offenses were. Each time the members of the board would say, "These are vague statements, you're not admitting your offense." At a certain point, he was told he was once again eligible to appeal for parole, but he declined. He knew that it would be a waste of his time. In the end, he was paroled after 16 years and 7 months. He could have been out in 8 years had he confessed to a crime he did not commit, but he did not. He would not. Part of this time, he had been in Attica, a place whose name chills the blood. To other prisoners, rapists were only slightly above child molesters in how they were treated and abused. But his freedom was not really free. He was still on paper, as convicts say, with 11 years and 5 months to go. He was still under supervision, subject to reincarceration in the event of some offense. As a registered sex offender, he knew he would go to the top of any suspect list. He was terrified that he would be arrested for some crime committed by another person. And who would hire such a person? He decided that he would only take jobs that were at night and that required him to punch a clock to prove his presence in a warehouse or wherever he was working. He knew that in the dark hours were when sexual assaults occurred, and he wanted to have an unequivocal alibi. His cousin had introduced him to a woman named Elizabeth. When they started getting close, he said, "I like you, but I want you to know about my past." He gave her a folder containing the records of his case. She went into another room and spent the evening reading the transcripts. She came out sobbing. "I believe you. You did not commit this offense." Meanwhile, Alice Siebel's career had taken off. She had an article in the New York Times and was on Oprah. Once her novel was a bestseller and on the screen, her other book, The Story of Her Rape, also became a bestseller. It was being used in classrooms across the country. She was seen as a brave young woman, speaking the truth, telling what had happened to her, a story that other women were not brave enough to tell. The response was so strong that there was a decision to make a film. A noted female writer was chosen to work on the script. Of course, she read the book on which the script was to be based. When she got to the chapter on the trial, she stopped. Somehow, it did not make sense to her. Two issues of evidence jumped out. First, the identification of the suspect was 6 months after the rape. Witness identifications are notoriously unreliable, and yet that seemed to be a key factor in the conviction. Aviv reports that when the witness and the suspect are of different races, misidentification is around 50%. Once again, let me inject myself into this story. I was in Jerusalem when John Demjanjuk of Cleveland was convicted of being the notorious death camp murderer Ivan the Terrible, who seemed to enjoy what he was doing. I followed the trial in the local papers. At one point, an elderly survivor of the camp was asked if Ivan the Terrible was in the courtroom. She pointed to Demjanjuk, sitting in a place for the accused. She became hysterical as she sobbed and shouted, "Yes, that's him! There he is!" This was 40-plus years later. She was reliving the trauma of her youth and was identifying a feeble old man as the young man who had murdered people in front of her so long ago. It later turned out that Ivan the Terrible had been executed by the Russians even before the war ended. The American officials who processed Demjanjuk's deportation so he could be tried in Israel knew that, but withheld it from their superiors and from his defense attorneys. But there were those witnesses. They knew what they saw, and they wanted justice. In fact, they deserved justice. But again, witness testimony was very unreliable, especially where a desire for righteous vengeance is concerned. The second thing the scriptwriter noticed was the matter of the misidentification in the lineup. It was not as if Siebel was hiding it. It was right there in the memoir, along with the rationalization by the prosecutor that such mistakes often happen in lineups, and that Broadwater had rigged the identification process, and that changing the person you identified was okay. The scriptwriter decided to conduct her own investigation. She spoke to the prosecutor, now retired, and received explanations that were not convincing. At this point, she pulled out of the project. She no longer had confidence in the credibility of the story. There was also a problem with finding an actor to play the rapist. They tested several black actors and finally settled on one who seemed exceptionally well-suited. But he began to have doubts. Even during the screen test, he found it difficult to simulate a rape of the stand-in actress. When he saw the photos of Broadwater, he said he was heartbroken. He had kind, unassuming eyes. He looked like someone I had grown up with. He prayed about the issue and then withdrew from the project. The scriptwriter changed the rapist to a white man, and the project collapsed. As Siebel said more than once, "I wish my rapist had been white." In time, the whole case fell apart and the conviction was vacated. This was 39 years after Broadwater was found guilty. Her publisher immediately withdrew the memoir and ceased all sales. The state of New York settled with Broadwater for $5.5 million in a wrongful conviction lawsuit. Prosecutorial misconduct might be another term. But now what? Both Siebold and Broadwater were left with this tragedy, the tragedy of this grievous injustice. Actually, there were multiple injustices. Siebold had been raped and had her 18-year-old innocence ripped from her. She was trapped forever in the experience of that 18-year-old girl, on her back, her head bleeding from being hit with a brick, lying on a bed of broken glass, trying to figure out how to survive. As she wrote in Lovely Bones, life is a perpetual yesterday. And she knew that she had allowed her eloquence and her poise and her desire for justice, or was it revenge, to drive her to the conviction of an innocent man. And there was Broadwater, 2 years older than Siebold, who had lost his youth and his future, and had suffered, we know not what, in the New York prison system. And there was an element of the story that surprised me. Siebold decided that she would never write again. She said she could never, quote, return to the place where I perceive words as inherently kind and playful. What I thought was the truth and wrote about as the truth, which then was validated year after year for 20-plus years as a never-out-of-print title. That was not only never the truth, but the truth resided with Anthony B. I think I can understand this, but again, I have to enter the story on behalf of myself. Understand or not, that really upset me. Siebold's ability to write is not just a talent, it's a gift. She is beyond good. She captures things with her words that no one else could capture. How could she walk away from that? Soon after the conviction was vacated, Siebold sent Broadwater a one-page apology. I'm sorry most of all for the fact that the life you could have led was unjustly robbed from you. And I know that no apology can change what happened to you, and never will. My goal in 1982 was justice, certainly not forever and irreparably to alter a young man's life by the very crime that had altered mine. Broadwater commented, I thank the good Lord I made it to a point where I'm strong enough mentally to say, hey, it was the court. It was the system. It's not the victim's fault. The story upset me a lot, for more than one reason. Both of the main characters had their lives destroyed. They were stripped of happiness that could never be restored. Siebold's memoir discusses her personal life after the trial. Even in the midst of success, she careened from drugs to alcohol to boyfriend after boyfriend and into and out of marriage. If there was joy in that life, it was not obvious. And for her to give up her writing, her gift, that must have been pain beyond pain. I bumped into my minister as I was reflecting on these issues and told him of the story. How can anyone move beyond such pain? I asked him. I was not expecting an answer, and he did not offer one. But he did have an idea. It was summer, and he had arranged for an in-the-park discussion group that would focus upon complex issues. He suggested that I raise this with the group. There were probably 8 or 10 people there when the event occurred. I gave them a 3 or 4 minute summary of the story and what I saw as the ultimate dilemma. When you cause such grievous pain to another person, a harm that cannot be reversed, how can you heal that permanent wound? Some people turn to forgiveness as a way out. That was the Christian teaching, forgiveness, mercy, love, compassion, recognizing the humanity of the other person. That seemed to be the approach of Broadwater, who had said he forgave Siebold. I found that remarkable. But that was an option for Broadwater. It was not an option Siebold had. He was the victim. Her testimony had caused him harm. It had stripped him of his youth and had branded him permanently as a rapist. If he forgave her, that might free him from his anger and protect him from being re-victimized. But Siebold did not have that option. She was certainly a victim, a grievously harmed victim. That rape had been more than an involuntary sexual encounter with an aggressive boyfriend. That would have been bad enough, but it was violent and brutal. Certainly, she could have forgiven her unknown rapist, but she decided that she would never do that. And no one would expect her to. She certainly could not forgive Broadwater. He had done her no harm. and in fact at the point where he was in a morally superior position and could have renounced her, he chose an alternative path. He chose the path of kindness and mercy. He spared her at least part of her potential suffering. As St. Paul said, such kindness to a person who harmed you will heap bitter ashes on his head. With the intellectual turmoil and confusion I was experiencing, I thought of that novel, The Shack, published in 2007. It was about a father who took his family on a camping trip. His young daughter was kidnapped, raped, and murdered. The focus of the story, it involved moral teaching, was that if you cannot find a way to humanize the murderer, you will just re-victimize yourself. My church at the time had a discussion of this book. I was uncharacteristically silent. I was thinking to myself, if someone raped and murdered one of my granddaughters, I would never forgive him. Never. But I also thought of my former student, whose father had been murdered. He actually went to the prison to visit with the murderer. Not only was he a regular visitor, but he made himself available for public discussions of why he did that, and of why not only by forgiving the murderer could he free himself. As I mentioned to our Siebel discussion group, a scene in the film Gandhi. During the partition of India, there were massacres in Calcutta involving Muslims and Hindus. Gandhi had gone on a fast unto death, as he called it, unless the killing stopped. At one point, a deranged Hindu broke through security and approached Gandhi's bed. His aides feared an assassination attempt, but it was something very different. The man was in grievous pain. He said to Gandhi, "I am going to hell." Gandhi asked him why. He said his son had been killed by Muslims and that he had gone out and found a Muslim child and murdered him in revenge. He knew that God would never forgive such an offense. Gandhi said, "I cannot restore your son, but I can get you out of hell. You must find a Muslim child whose parents have been murdered by Hindus. You must adopt him and raise him as your own son, and you must raise him as a Muslim." The man went away realizing that loving such a child would indeed rescue him from his torture. Last year, I was thinking about something that happened when I was 16 or so. There was a girl in our small church who was very much a marginalized person. Most of us were marginalized in one way or another, but she was more marginalized than most. Her parents had several children and little money. Her father was not a good man. But she had a brother who was a local media personality. I would make derogatory comments about him to her. It was very mean-spirited on my part, and I knew it. We were not rich, but my parents had two kids and a regular income. In that sense, I was very privileged, and she was not. I recently talked to someone who had been active in the church at that time and said, "I wish I knew her address so I could send her an apology." After 60 or so years, it would probably not do much good, but it would do me some good. But no one seemed to know where she was, and I was left to live with my offenses. My friend said, "You confess to God and ask for forgiveness, and God will forgive you." That was a reassuring thought, but what I did not want to do was fall into the trap that Dietrich Bonhoeffer had warned Christians to avoid. He called it cheap grace. The Christian teaching is that God's mercy, i.e. grace, is available to anyone who has committed an offense and who asks for forgiveness. But Bonhoeffer says the danger is that we will grant it to ourselves without doing the painful work necessary to heal the wounds we have created. The Catholic Church, Siebold is a Catholic, says there's a process called reconciliation. You must admit your offense, try to make peace with the person you have harmed, and pay penance. Then you can be forgiven. Exactly what penance would be in the case of Alice Siebold is not clear. But I have a thought. I would like to see her turn to her gift, not away from it. I would like to see her write another memoir. This one would be a reflection upon how she came to be the offender, even the assailant, in a case where she had started as a victim. She would discuss the danger of righteous vengeance. She would have to be careful not to make herself the hero of the story. She is definitely not a hero. She should publish this along with the documentary records in her case. Let her readers see the evidence. She should go on a book tour, appearing on television programs and at book readings. She should warn people against the desire to get revenge or to crush those who have harmed you. And she should warn people against using the structures of power as instruments for their retaliation. She should ask them to consider whether they are in a position of power or privilege before they decide upon a course of action. She should urge readers to consider whether they have reached a wrong conclusion or whether there is an alternative short of formal process. And she should ask that anyone who ever used her previous memoir in class or in a discussion group will now use this one as well. And she should make it clear that all profits from this book will go to the Innocence Project. They seek to free persons unjustly convicted of crimes. They have far more cases than they have funds to help them. This might help. I think Gandhi would like this proposal. Thanks for listening, and try to find that article by Rachel Aviv in The New Yorker. It is available on the internet. It is entitled Words Fail. It was published May 29, 2023. It has in-depth richness that this podcast cannot capture.